It's The Fake Show, starring Kendall Tenney and Jim Tofte.
Welcome to the podcast, and it is a thrill and a pleasure to have original Paul Revere and the Raiders member Phil Fang Volk, the bass player for the Raiders. Not only having him on the podcast, but the fact that Phil and his lovely wife, Tina Mason, actually came over to my house, and they're sitting in my kitchen with me. It's just really surreal to me right now, you guys.
Well, you know, that's okay, really, because, you know, it's kind of surreal to me, too.
I know. Well, you know, you guys were saying you got lost on the way over here, which doesn't surprise me.
We drove around in circles in this neighborhood, but it's a beautiful neighborhood. I love
Thank
your
you.
Furnishings. It's very warm and homey. But thanks for the invite, Jim. It's always good talking with you.
I'm a big fan. I've told you, Phil, when I was a kid, obviously everybody loved the Beatles and the Stones and everything else, but you guys were on TV so much, and I believe you set the record for it. I just loved you guys because of all the showmanship, and you could actually play, and your songs were great. It's some of the best pop music, I think, in the history of music.
I would say some of the best rock music, because we were rockers. Way before we got famous, we were in that dance circuit for years up there in the Northwest, you know, Oregon, Washington, Canada, Northern California, Idaho, because Paul was from Idaho. You know, when we did a dance, we did like three or four sets for packed out audiences. In fact, much to Dick Clark's chagrin, he came to town with one of his big, you know, star-studded Caravan of Stars tours with Frankie Avalon and Connie Francis and Bobby Vinton and all, you know, all these recording artists that were already popular. And he came to Portland, Oregon. There was only like half a crowd there, half a house. So he went to the stage manager and said, "Where's all the kids? Where's all the teenagers?" The stage manager said, "Well, tonight there's a real popular band playing at the D Street Corral," which was a huge dance hall. He said, "They're all there to see that band." He says, "What's the name of the band?" He says, "A group called Paul Revere and the Raiders." So obviously that piqued his curiosity. He saw what we were doing. He saw our showmanship, like you were mentioning.
Yeah.
And he said, "Man, this band would be great for my new show, Where the Action Is."
Yeah, you stole my crowd, so I might as well.
Yeah.
You can't beat them, join them, right?
You've already proven that you can take away my audience. We were only hired as a kind of a backup band.
Kind of like a house band, right?
Kind of like a house band that wouldn't be featured that prominently. But after the first season, there was so much fan mail. "Hey, let's have more Raiders. These guys are wild and crazy, and they're fun."
Had you on every weekday,
right? It was 5 days a week.
It was like MTV before MTV even existed.
Exactly.
I mean, it was a great concept.
It was all like music videos before music videos, because all the popular artists would come on of the day. You know, James Brown. I think I just showed you a picture of James Brown with us, and Otis Redding, Stevie Wonder, The Temptations, The Byrds. Every recording artist who has ever had a hit record was on that TV show.
Now, I know you're young at the time. You guys are in your 20s, but it had to be hard work to do an everyday show like that.
Well, for the Raiders, it wasn't just the show, because as you know, we were with Columbia Records. We had to record albums. Once we started getting hit records, because the show, you could feature a song one day on the show, a new release, and the whole nation would hear it.
So it was a great launching point for your new single.
Yeah, it was
single.
A launch pad for the singles, and so we really started to generate a lot of record sales, which also meant we had to go on the road. So we had these long 2-month tours, then we had all the photo shoots. Of course, the magazines jumped into the mix, and we had to do a lot of magazine articles and interviews and radio spots. And then not only did we do Where the Action Is, but we did all the other TV shows, even a series of Batman.
I remember seeing it, and I watched it recently on YouTube. It reminds me a lot of what Tom Hanks did with That Thing You Do. You know, he had them as the house band in a movie. And
yeah, you know, when we did Batman, you know, with Adam West and Burt Ward, the Penguin, who was played by Burgess Meredith, was running for mayor of Gotham City against Batman. That was the premise.
That was the premise, yeah.
Okay, we were with the villain, you know, we were with Penguin, his house band for his campaign session, and we meet people that are so excited that we were on Batman. They just can't contain themselves, because it's such a great, it's like being in an episode of Star Trek.
Was it exciting for you guys at the time?
Oh, it was thrilling. We spent the whole day there. We played live. That's little live music that you hear, that we actually played that music. Because, you know, in those days, they did a lot of lip syncing. But everything we did on the Batman show was live. We just made it up there for the director. He said, "We need something to accompany this belly dancer." It's just a fabulous credit to have in your profile, in your resume. But we did the Hollywood Palace. We did Hullabaloo, Shindig, of course, the Ed Sullivan Show, which is kind of like the pinnacle. We were on the Smothers Brothers, and they were great to work with. You know, they were also very controversial in their own way, with the way they were, their comedy was very edgy and very relevant.
Jokes they were doing about Vietnam
and political and stuff. And they were great guys to work for. Even though they may look a little square on the outside, they were very, very hip.
Yeah.
And we did Coliseum in New York with Woody Allen.
Really?
I mean, and this was before Woody Allen was really a big movie director.
He was a comedian?
He was just a stand-up comedian, and I don't think he had done any films yet. Maybe he had. This was in like 66. He was still just a funny guy.
Did he open for you guys then? Is that how
he
it
was
worked?
The host of Coliseum, which was a big variety show. It had circus acts. It had music acts, jugglers, dancers, singers, and we were the rock band. Woody Allen was at the dress rehearsal with us, and he said, you know, I got to go back to my apartment, and I got to get some different clothes. These clothes are very soiled. They kind of smell a little bit. I want to get a different shirt and a different tie. And, you know, he's very nervous and fidgety. And they didn't want him to leave because they didn't want him to take a taxi cab and get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so I jump in because I had to go to a music store, which seemed to be close to where his apartment was.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, Woody, I got to go to the music store down there. I got to get some guitar strings and some picks. And I'll take you in our limousine. Our limousine driver is sitting there right on the curb.
Yeah.
Waiting for us to, you know, after dress rehearsal, he's going to take us here or there. Why don't you just come with me? I'll take you to your place. You get your stuff. I'll go to the store. I'll get my stuff. And we'll come back. And we'll be back at the same time. And the director said, that's a great idea. Woody, why don't you do that? So here we are. This is one of my fun stories in life. Here I am sitting in a limousine all alone with Woody Allen.
That's amazing.
This fidgety little funny guy. And he was so nervous that he just kept talking.
Did he know who you guys were? Was he aware of?
You know, I don't think he was hugely into the rock scene.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he was the host of the show and he did his homework. He knew we were famous. He knew we had hit records. But I don't think rock and roll was his main thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably more into jazz.
Yeah, right.
The big band or whatever.
Sure.
Because of his age group and era.
That's what he does, too.
Yeah, yeah. But so, anyway, no, that's Woody Herman. Just kidding.
Nice.
So here we are. If you can just visualize, he's sitting on the big back seat of the limo. We're looking at each other. And there we are. Quack, quack,
and it
quack,
made that
quack.
Sound.
Wasn't that the penguin? Quack, quack.
Please, Phil, turn your phone down during the broadcast.
So I'm sitting there. He's looking at me. I'm looking at him. It's kind of silent, uncomfortably silent, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of a pregnant pause. So he started talking. So how long you been with this group here, Paul Revere Raiders? He just started asking me like these very, you know, elementary
just
questions.
Just to keep it moving.
Yeah, just to keep a conversation. Mm-hmm. I've been with him for about 2 years. Well, do you like it? Do you like it? Do you like it? Do you like it?
That's
and
great.
You could tell the guy was a nervous wreck. I said, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Well, what do you do? Do you tour? Do you record? What do you do? I said, well, we do a little bit of everything. We record, we tour, we do a TV show. Oh, that's right, Dad, the Dick Clark thing. Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Oh, here's my apartment. Tell the driver to stop right here. So he gets
out. Did you make it back in time?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a good idea. The plan worked. And this is surreal to sit across a guy like that who has become such an icon.
Yes.
Such a strange figure, so left of center, and yet he was displaying some of those odd qualities then.
Yeah.
I was just rolling with it because...
Little did you know, he was this genius who would write several movies.
Right, right. So it was fun. It's a memory I'll never forget.
So with Where the Action Is, you guys had reached such fame. How much stuff was going on?
Are you talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Well, you know, I know that it got to the point where it was very much like...
We got our hair pulled out. We got our costumes ripped to shreds. We did a public appearance in Boston, just like a promotion appearance. And they announced on the radio that Paul Revere and the Raiders will be at the Boston Commons, which is near the famous graveyard in the North Church where Paul Revere had his lantern.
Right.
And they'll be signing autographs. So we arrived there in a brand new Cadillac owned by one of the Columbia Records representatives because it was a Columbia Records promotion tour. We get there and there's 5,000 kids waiting for us. The driver of the car said, what's this all about? I said, well, we tried to tell you, you know, the people, the kids know us from the show, and it's going to be a riot. I hope you have some riot police here. No. And
they were not prepared for that.
Yeah, and no. And the kids jumped on top of his brand new Cadillac and flattened his roof. We were laying on our backs, holding the roof up with our feet. And he said, get out, get out. They're ruining my car. Get out. And so we got out. And what happens? They start tearing on us because it's a mob consciousness.
Sure.
Maybe one kid or two kids, they can't do much harm. But when you get 5,000 kids with that mob consciousness, it's just chaos. We had these brand new outfits. They got ripped to shreds. In the process, we all got separated. Smitty was running through the graveyard, hopping over the tombstones, and you could see a whole line of kids following him. Drake got stuck inside of the phone booth, trying to hold the door closed. Paul Revere, of course, went to where he belonged, in the North Church,
of
in
course,
the tower.
Yes. The British were coming.
Yeah. And me and Mark were just being, what's the word? Eviscerated?
That's emasculated? A good one. That's a good one.
Whatever it is, they were tearing at everything we had. And finally, the riot police came with a paddy wagon. They finally loaded us in while the kids are tearing at us. They got us all inside the back end of this coach, this paddy wagon. You know, it was like a big van. And this old policeman tried to shut the door of the back of the paddy wagon. He was probably ready for retirement. This was probably his last day on the job. And they took off with him hanging on the rear door. And the poor guy went flying around on that door until he finally fell off.
Oh my gosh.
And he broke his arm. And so they brought us to the governor's office, the governor of Massachusetts, and he presented us with a silver bowl of Paul Revere. Because, you know, Paul Revere, the original guy, was a silversmith. And we got a lot of great photo ops on this, and it shows in one of the magazines that Columbia Records put out, a great photo essay of our promotion tour. And this was one of the crazy things that happened on the tour. But we all felt so bad about that policeman hanging on the back door. And he was probably close to 60.
He had no idea what he was doing.
And he was
there,
flopping back and forth, and the door kept slapping back on him. And that was only one of the big riots that happened on that promotion tour. That happened almost in every city.
Like you say, you guys had really worked on your chops even before Where the Action Is. Because you were doing stuff that was very raw garage rock type stuff. You were doing
R&B stuff.
Night Train.
That was an instrumental. Let's see what else you got there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we did a lot of R&B tunes, Ray Charles stuff, like What I Say, and we did Money by Barrett Strong. And that was...
And was Mark still playing saxophone at that point?
Yes. Mark was. And I've always said this in interviews, and I hope he hears this someday, and I've complimented him many, many times. He was one of the best sax players of the 60s, bar none.
Really?
And Paul Revere helped him learn how to play sax. Paul would not hire him into the band until he played an instrument, because Paul Revere didn't think he'd get enough mileage out of a guy who was just a singer. It was kind of a put down to lead singers, but but in those days, instrumentals were big, because Paul started as a piano instrumentalist, right, with Like Long Hair. And just to kind of dovetail into that title, Like Long Hair, when Paul Revere died last year, October 4th, we miss him so much, dear friend of ours, Paul Schaefer on the David Letterman Show did a special tribute to Paul Revere, and he played Paul Revere's first hit record, like Long Hair.
Nice. And is that where the band dressed up in Raider gear? Because I remember seeing that.
They did that too many, many years ago.
Yeah.
That was very timely too, because Drake Levin, the original guitar player, he's also gone. Drake was getting ready to go in the hospital for cancer surgery on his throat, and I was there with him in San Francisco before he went in, and Paul Schaefer comes on the Letterman Show dressed up like the Raiders. All the guys in the band had Raider outfits on, and the whole night was dedicated to Raider music.
Awesome.
David Letterman says, Paul, what are you doing? You look a little different tonight. He says, well, we're paying tribute to America's number one show band, Paul Revere and the Raiders. It goes without saying that showmanship was an integral part of our presentation.
Speaking of which, you and Drake, or you and Jim Valley, the dance steps, the choreography. I mean, when as a kid, as I watched you guys, it was entertaining and everything else. But now, as I look at some of those clips, that was pretty complicated stuff considering you were singing and playing at the same time. I mean, that was really well-rehearsed stuff.
Those steps were complicated, and we worked hard on them. Hey, the Temptations had some great dance steps, and a lot of those Motown acts.
Yeah, but they weren't holding guitars. And
they weren't playing and singing, necessarily. Well, or playing a guitar. I know they sang and did steps, but there was nothing uncool. Let me go on the record as saying there was nothing uncool about doing dance steps and playing rock and roll. In those days, it was exceptionally cool to do all of that at the same time. People thought it was great. They loved it, you know?
Yeah, it made
and
you
wearing
stand
outfits.
Out,
everybody
too.
Wore outfits. I mean, look how the Young Rascals came out in those little knickers. And those little short ties like schoolboys. You know, we all wore stuff. All the Motown acts wore special costumes.
Remember Gary Puckett and the Union Gap?
The Union Gap, they had the Southern Confederate look going, right? It was a lot of work behind the scenes to really synchronize those things. And when we did the Johnny Carson show in 66, we did one of our most extreme visual choreographed pieces called Big Boy Pete. It wasn't even a hit record of ours, but we did it because it was so visual. And that's when Drake and I had that guitar battle.
Right.
You know, where we swing at each other's heads.
Over the top of each other.
And we'd come real, we swing real fast. I mean, if that guitar head, high headstock hit the guy in the head, that would kill him.
Is this clip available anywhere?
Yes.
I just
recently got a clip of it. It's been so hard to find, but a friend of ours in New York actually went to the Carson archive people and bought the clip for me.
That stuff is hard to...
This was the most... And the thing that makes this clip so wonderful, it's entirely live. No lip syncing. Everything is real. And this really shows and settles the argument. Did these guys really know how to play or what? We played all the instruments on all our records. We were the players. And like you said, we did that dance circuit for so long. We had to be great players to do that hard dance circuit and do four sets a night.
How did the choreography begin? Where did that start?
Way back when Mark and Paul were forming the group, and Drake and I weren't in the group yet, they did a little choreography. When Drake got in the group, Drake was a great dancer. They started adding to the repertoire of dance steps to be even more visual, and they brought in the Raider outfits. You know, we were wearing like Beetle jackets, you know, little short Nehru jackets,
sure.
And we had a very cool look, but it wasn't a funny look. As soon as we put on the revolutionary outfits, all of a sudden, we could be funny. It made you feel funny, and the crowd loved it. So once they got the outfits on, they never left that concept because it worked so well.
You eventually have a costumer, someone who
Jeannie the tailor. She made our initial outfits for us, and then we had to hire bigger companies because we needed several versions of the outfit because, you know, we'd sweat so much on every dance set. We needed to rotate the outfits so the other ones could dry out and stuff.
Getting back to the dancing really for one more moment. So Drake leaves the band and Jim Valley comes in and he's got to learn that stuff pretty quick, doesn't he?
He's got to learn it quick. And, you know, I was telling you about the Big Boy Pete dance choreography where we swing our guitar next to each other. Drake and I had that down to a science. And when Jim Valley came in, the first time we performed that in concert, he hit me in the head. He got a little too close. It's all time to the rhythm of the song. And just somehow I was a little early on his swing and I hadn't ducked enough. And bam, right in the temple. Just about knocked me silly.
Oh.
we had a nice talk with the powerful after that.
I'll bet you did.
You know, Tommy James of the Shondells saw us do that on Where the Action Is. He thought it was such a fabulous visual thing. He said, "Hey guys, we got to steal that. Let's do that on our show." So they go back east and they open up this big swank club on the East Coast and they try this bit. And the first time the guy swings at the guitar player, he hits him right in the skull and rips off the guy's toupee because the guy was wearing a rug and it goes flying.
Kind of funny. They should have just written that into the act.
Well, the hair piece goes flying into the front row. You know, the tables that have those big candles in the middle of the table, and it landed right on the candle and the whole thing caught on fire. It was like a flash fire and everybody had to evacuate the room immediately. Once they got it cleared up, the crowd came back. Tommy James goes on to, he says, after the show, he had a lot of the fans coming up to him and said, "Man, that bit with the hairpiece and the fire, that's great. Do you do that every night?" And of course, to remain cool and not make it sound like it was a mistake, Tommy said, "No, we only do that on opening night just to get people talking about the show."
Just occasionally.
We thought that, you know, the fire and the evacuation was pretty exciting. Yeah. And word of mouth will spread and people come to the show next night. He got a lot of mileage out of that story. But it's, you know, as they say, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Yeah. We did that on the Johnny Carson show, and of course Johnny had high kudo remarks for us, and he really complimented us. And
I'd love to see that sometime.
Yeah,
clip. But you can't find that because there are a lot of episodes of Carson that are gone.
They say that a lot of those Carson clips were destroyed or something.
There was a fire, I think.
But we found our clip.
That's great.
And they said the 60s were obliterated, but guess what? They may have found them through other sources like kinescopes and stuff that the networks kind of hold on to. They're second generation, but they're pretty clean still.
Is Where the Action ever going to be released?
This is the question that most of the fans want answered. I'll give this answer, and this is what I know. The Dick Clark production office has indicated to some people that I've spoken to that they want to put together some compilation, but they only can use the artists that were under contract with Dick Clark because they own those performances. Like when a guest artist would come on, like the Temptations or Otis Redding, they weren't under contract. They were just guests on the show. But the groups that they can use, of course, is Paul Revere and the Raiders, because we were contracted to do that show. And Tina Mason, my dear wife, she was on it for a year. Steve Lamo and the Hard Times and the Knickerbockers. And Tommy Rowe was contracted for a while. So they can use all the clips and the dancers of the Action Family. And so they're thinking about maybe doing something along those lines.
Good. I'd love to see it, because I know that shows like Shindig and Hullabaloo and some of those other shows have episodes that are out there now.
Yeah, and Hullabaloo came out with a compilation, which is cool because we were on Hullabaloo numerous times.
Yeah. Your time with the band ended right after Spirit of 67, I believe, and that was one of my favorites. I really like that album a lot, with Good Thing, The Great Airplane Strike, and Hungry. It was just so great. But you also had some really cool songs on that, In My Community and Why. I liked your voice a lot, and I have the feeling that Paul, maybe Mark, were kind of blocking you and Drake and whoever else may have had some ideas of their own on the album. And was that something that maybe led to you guys going off on your own?
That was part of the downfall. That was kind of the beginning of the end, because in those days, in 67, people were writing songs. The Beatles had become very famous as songwriters, not just as a band, but songwriters, and everybody wanted to put their original songs. Not only was it part of the art and part of their craft, but it was also very lucrative to be the songwriter and the artist and the producer in that case, and that's kind of where it went. And we wanted our songs to be relevant. We just didn't see eye to eye. Mark Lindsay had his own vision of how the band should go, and
he wanted to stick with the teeny bop thing
was more of his groove, and he liked the adoration. But Drake and Smitty and I were writing songs together, and we were talking about a new concept. If the Raiders didn't work out, we'd form a group called Brotherhood.
How early on were you talking about that? How far back did that go?
It probably went back about 6 months before we actually gave Paul our notice that we were leaving. And Drake Levin came on that last tour because Harpo had already left the band. And based on what we're talking about, Harpo was disenchanted that he didn't get any songs on the Spirit of 67. And that was his reason for leaving. Now, I got a couple songs, so I was fairly happy. But I knew that it was always going to be a struggle to have our fair share of the original songs on the album, especially based on what Mark was getting on the album. Because he got the lion's share. And he just shared the writers with Paul. And so the two of them did okay in that area.
He was writing with Terry Melcher a little bit,
he was basically writing with Terry, but he would always include Paul in the writership.
Uh-huh.
You know, because that was their deal. I'm just sure that Paul, you know, having his eye on the dollar like he did, he was a businessman. He says, well, if that's the way it's going to be, then I want a cut of that action.
I want to own it, right?
Not that he was always there writing with it, but he was there approving it or saying, giving the green light to Mark to do this and do that. And so that's what kind of started to break down the communication and our togetherness and the team spirit, because the vision of the band in that year, when things were changing, things were getting a lot more relevant, especially because of the war.
Pretty heavy times.
And the riots on the street, and then Hendrix was getting edgy, and the Beatles were getting edgy, and we didn't want to miss out on that pocket of music that was starting to really say something, still be good rock and music, but it still had some relevance.
I'll have more with Phil Volk of Paul Revere and the Raiders in part two of our conversation when we talk about what he did after the breakup and what he's up to now that he's living in Las Vegas. For Kendall Tenney, I'm Jim Tofte with The Fake Show.
Join Kendall and Jim next time from Studio G inside Jim Tofte's house, and go to thefakeshow.com for more info.